From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from the Wisconsin chair of the Democratic Committee on why he's campaigning to become the national chair.
I've seen what works in Wisconsin, and I know that even if each race in each place is a little bit different, being in the fight makes a difference everywhere.
Then we'll learn about the season of Advent and its origins in Christian history. Plus, we'll speak with a Wisconsin artist who recently gained attention for his series of tiny paintings inside Altoid tins.
I just had an Altoid container laying around, and at that point I had been oil painting for about a year, so I decided to just try it out and put some paint in the bottom of the tin, use that as the palette.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Democrats are hoping to rebound from losing the presidential race last month, and Wisconsin Democratic Party Chair Ben Wickler says he's the right person to lead the party's efforts across the nation. Wickler is one of at least four candidates running to be the chair of the Democratic National Committee. The election is scheduled for February 1st. WUWM's Chuck Kornbach is joined by Wickler to find out why he's running and what he hopes to achieve.
I'm running for chair of the Democratic National Committee because to defeat MAGA and the far-right billionaires who want to rig the country for Trump and his friends, we have to unite the Democratic Party. We have to fight everywhere and on every platform in every state year-round, as we have done in Wisconsin. And if we do that, we will win more elections in more places and have the chance to deliver for working families no matter where they live or what they look like.
How are you going to help transform Democratic messaging, maybe to focus on at least what some polling says voters showed they were more concerned about, for example, the economy, still important, but a little bit less on abortion rights?
Well, we know that voters will give a serious look at a candidate if they feel like that candidate is on their side. And right now, a lot of Democrats get their news about Democrats from Republicans. Republicans are communicating in more places more of the time than Democrats are. And there are folks who voted for change who don't trust either party, who didn't hear either party's message in this election. So what that means for Democrats is that we need to show up in places that are not centrally about politics. We need to reach out to voters who are not watching political news, and we need to go on hostile territory and make our case. No one else is going to make it for us. My view is that when Democrats say what they're for fighting for working families and for the freedom that everyone deserves as Americans, this should be our birthright, that those are winning messages. We just need to make sure people actually hear them.
Do you anticipate more focused messages about the economy or holding down prices, reducing prices?
Well, we know Trump's first priority as president, which is a multi-trillion dollar tax cut for billionaires. That is on the legislative agenda next year. And every Democrat across all the different types of folks who make up this Big Ten party, we all oppose that. We think the economy should work for working people, not as a vehicle to distribute wealth up to those at the very, very top. So I think that's a big uniting fight that is going to make clear whose side we're on and whose side the GOP is on. And when you fight a fight, it shows your values, who you're for, what you're about. That is the way that we win, is by fighting the battles that make clear that we're on the side of working folks across this country and across the state, and we're not trying to rig the country for the far-right billionaire special interests that dominate the incoming Trump administration.
Is there room for tax cuts for the middle class and lower-income folks?
Democrats have delivered tax cuts for the middle class, for low-income, lower-income folks, and you can do that by ensuring that the ultra-wealthy pay their fair share. The Republicans want to do the reverse. They want to stick middle-class families and working families with the bill in order to give tax cuts to the super rich. And for Democrats, this is a core uniting value that we need to demonstrate is a central part of what our work in politics is all about. And I think we're going to be able to do that, and it's going to help us to win elections all over the country, all over the state of Wisconsin, and everywhere else in these next 4 years.
If you're elected DNC chair, what would be sort of a day one goal for you or day one announcement?
Day one, we start building the strategy for a year-round permanent campaign across the country. And let me explain what I mean by that. In our state of Wisconsin, We finished the 2024 election and immediately started working to ensure that Susan Crawford wins the state Supreme Court race on April 1st of 2025. We're gearing up for an organizing push around that race right now, and that'll affect the future of freedom, of dignity, of all the things we care about. For working folks across the state of Wisconsin, defeating Brad Schimmel is essential. And there are fights like that in every state, but they don't get the national spotlight. They don't get the kind of intensity and support that in Wisconsin we know is essential to winning races like the April 1st Supreme Court race. And that work to build up that permanent campaign infrastructure, it has to start right away.
There's been a lot of success for Democrats in Wisconsin as you've been state chair. But, you know, how much of that is attributable to you and how much to, you know, pretty good candidates like Tony Evers, Tammy Baldwin, and Janet Protasiewicz?
Winning elections starts with having amazing candidates. And we are so lucky to have champions and public servants like the governor and Governor Evers, Senator Baldwin, the Supreme Court justices. And you need to organize and communicate everywhere to ensure that voters hear about how great those candidates are. And we've built a mighty campaign infrastructure in every corner of Wisconsin that helps with all the races that come along and plays a critical role in partnership with our allies and the full coalition. That's the approach that we should have at the Democratic National Committee, too, to have the kind of infrastructure that allows us to fight and win elections and lift up the amazing candidates who run for office in every geography, in every community across the United States. That's the reason I'm running for DNC chair, because I've seen what works in Wisconsin. And I know that even if each race in each place is a little bit different, being in the fight makes a difference everywhere.
A couple of questions I know you've been asked before, and I want to give you the chance to maybe go in more depth than I've seen. Why did Kamala Harris lose Wisconsin while Tammy Baldwin won? Did the Harris campaign do enough in Wisconsin?
The Harris campaign prioritized Wisconsin from day one, which I'm so grateful for. They, working with our state party, with the coordinated campaign on the ground, tens of thousands of volunteers, turned out more voters for Harris than Biden had won in 2020 in a huge year. There were even more people who turned out for Donald Trump. The shift in Wisconsin towards Trump was smaller than any other battleground state, smaller than almost any state in the country. And some folks who turned out for Trump, they did not vote down ballot because Republicans didn't run the kind of coordinated campaign to make sure that a rising tide lifted all boats. So Tammy Baldwin had about the same number of votes as Kamala Harris, just a few thousand more, but Eric Hovde had way fewer votes than Donald Trump. And that is how you win a U.S. Senate race, thanks to the strength of our integrated permanent campaign approach in Wisconsin. While Republicans won the top of the ticket, but then lost the Senate race that I think they were counting on winning.
Still, despite your efforts, Harris did lose Wisconsin. Shouldn't the next DNC chair come from a state Democrats just won in the presidential race?
To me, what you look at in a fight is what worked and what needs to change. If you look across the country, you'll find that almost every state shifted towards Trump more than Wisconsin. We had one of the smallest shifts in the nation. We were the closest state in the country to winning, even though Trump campaigned here all the time. The states where Trump won shifted more towards Trump than we did in Wisconsin. And he didn't campaign in a lot of those states. So you can see the impact of the work that all of us did to try to move votes. Now, this isn't horseshoes. It doesn't count if you just get close, although we wouldn't have won the presidential, even if we'd lost Wisconsin. What matters is, did we do things that generated more votes for our side, that helped to shift people over to our side relative to the giant headwinds we faced across the country and that every incumbent government in the world has faced this year? All incumbent governments have lost vote share. And the answer is that what we did in Wisconsin, it did make a difference. Now, we need more. We need to reach more voters who are not hearing from Democrats. We need to bring the kind of intensity and organizing up and down the ballot forward. And also, we should recognize that the work that every volunteer did who knocked on doors in Wisconsin, it helped propel higher turnout, helped to win the U.S. Senate race, helped flip 14 state legislative races. Those things are going to affect people's lives directly, and that is something we can build on.
So which state Democrats carried in November at the presidential level should not be the only measuring stick, is that right?
The job of the Democratic National Committee is to raise the floor for Democrats up and down the ballot. And we have done that in Wisconsin. It wasn't enough to overcome the intensity of the headwinds in the presidential race. We lost by less than one percentage point. But the critical thing is to look under the hood at whether you're building a party that makes it more possible for Democrats at every level to be able to win. And if we do that, In 2028, we have a chance to win the presidential election, Democratic House and Senate majorities. In 26, we could win a Democratic trifecta in Wisconsin and many other states across the country. If we do this critical work, this early investment, organizing, and communication everywhere, starting now.
Question about money. Talk about, please, your ability to raise money for the Democratic Party. Could you duplicate your success in Wisconsin nationwide? Do you have strong enough connections to financially well-off people on the East and West Coast, as well as, you know, getting the $50 donations from the middle-income folks and lower-income folks?
As Democrats, we're up against the wealthiest people in the world pouring unbelievable sums of money into ensuring that Republicans take power, who will then make them even richer. And that means it'll take resources to fight back. And we have raised more resources at the Democratic Party of Wisconsin than any other Democratic state party in the country every single cycle that I've been chair. And we've done that by building a full spectrum fundraising operation that unites donors small and large, with grassroots donors, with cultural events like the Princess Bride reading, and with large donations around our strategy to unite, fight, and win everywhere in Wisconsin. I can do the same thing at the Democratic National Committee, and it's urgent that we do, because the stakes are this high. We need folks to support Democrats so that we can fight back and build an economy that works for everyone in this country, not just those at the very, very top.
Another candidate for DNC chair, Ken Martin of Minnesota, recently said he has endorsements from 18 or 20% of DNC voting members. How does that compare with the number you have? I know you've picked up some backing in the last week or so.
I've been thrilled at the support that we've already been able to find. I'm not counting my votes in public as we go. I've seen some of the great vote counters build their support and then share once they have a winning coalition. And I have every confidence that we have a very clear path to doing that. And I'm going to keep having my conversations with DNC members and with friends and allies to build this vision around a party that is ready to fight everywhere.
There's a pretty wide spectrum in the Democratic Party. Are you liberal enough to gain the support of Democrats who still like people like Bernie Sanders?
I come from a background at MoveOn.org and organizing in the progressive movement across the country and growing up in Wisconsin. And I also have learned to build coalitions with folks who may not agree on everything. We're a big tent party where folks can come together around fights that unite us as Democrats. And that will look different in different places. I've been talking to folks in deep red states where different messages work than in blue states and different things than in purple states. And yet for all Democrats, we know that we're the party that wins when we fight for working people, no matter where they live, what they look like, who they love, how they identify. Everyone needs a roof over their heads and food on the table, and everyone wants freedom and dignity and the chance to get ahead. Those values unite Democrats across the spectrum, and those are values that we can put into action in the fights that we fight in the coming years. So that is the work I've done at Move On against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act in Wisconsin to win elections up and down the ballot, and that's what I can do as DNC chair.
Just about done. Which state should hold the first Democratic Party primary in 2028? Do you have an opinion on that, or what sort of criteria would you look at?
The primary calendar for the 28 presidential race is a question that should be determined through a consultative process where DNC members weigh in, and we look for the path that helps us to choose a nominee that will win the general election, that honors our coalition, our tradition, our values, and gives an even playing field for candidates to jump in to make a name for themselves and have a shot at winning the nomination. I don't want to put my thumb on the scale in advance. I want to make sure we hear from all the voices of the folks in our community to make the best path forward, and then set a nominating calendar that unites the party and sets us up for victory.
Finally, since you announced your candidacy, there was President Biden's pardon of his son Hunter. I'd like to ask you, please, your opinion on that pardon. And the second part of the question is, how much will that pardon hurt Democratic candidates over the next 4 years?
Donald Trump is entering office with a blanket pledge to pardon the people who tried to overturn the election in 2020, the January 6th insurrectionists, with a FBI director nominee who's planning to weaponize the power of the federal government to go after the political enemies of Donald Trump, including family members of the president. That's the context in which President Biden made his decision, and that will be one of the dominant stories of these next 4 years. I don't think the American people are going to want the government using its power to go after people just because they disagree with the new president of the United States. And my big focus is gearing us up for those fights to come. They want to attack people to enrich their power, to enrich themselves, and we've got to fight back against that.
But will the pardon hurt Democrat candidates?
I think that the news cycles of this moment are going to be a very distant glimmer in the rearview mirror in a moment when Republicans are wreaking havoc across the country in an effort to try to rig the entire country to benefit the ultra, ultra wealthy. Preparing for that fight is my central focus.
Ben Winkler is the Wisconsin chair of the Democratic Committee and a candidate for the chair of the Democratic National Committee. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Quernbach. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll speak with an artist about his unique medium for painting portraits of Milwaukee. But first, we'll explore the season of Advent and its roots in Christian history. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Christmas is nearly here, which means the season of Advent is upon us. Although many of us may associate Advent with calendars full of goodies, the season itself is rooted in the history of Christianity. Father John Lawrence is a Jesuit priest and a former professor of theology at Marquette University. He joins me to share more about the evolution of this season. Father Lawrence, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
I'm very happy to be here, yes.
So when I think of Advent, I, like a lot of people, first think of those little cardboard calendars full of chocolates. But of course, Advent is really much more than that. What is the season of Advent?
What is it? I suppose you made me ask an existential question. What is it today? A lot of ways to look at that. It really is just a liturgical season and the church year. The church liturgical year, not to go too deeply here, but, you know, it's not mentioned in the New Testament or in the Bible. It developed over time from the original feast of Easter, which even then it isn't really recognized in the New Testament yet. You know, St. Paul says that Christ is our paschal lamb and who sacrificed for us, so let us keep the feast, but he's talking in probably a symbolic way. But that was the major feast of the year for a couple centuries there. It was only in the late 4th century that Advent began to develop. And so it's really a season of the year that, as we know today, is a preparation for the Feast of Christmas. And Christmas itself only came into existence in the 4th century. But Advent, therefore, is a kind of a preparation for a time of preparation to celebrate Christmas.
As you say, the origins are something that kind of develop over time. We have Christmas developing over centuries. Mm-hmm. We have Advent developing over centuries. What are some of the practices that are associated with this Advent season?
It really started in the Gallican area of the church, that is in France and Spain, and it was developed kind of in the beginning as a preparation for baptisms at Epiphany. Just like their baptisms at Easter, they had the practice of their baptisms at Epiphany on the 6th of January, and that kind of was still their Christmas day, the 6th of January, because that's the way it was celebrated in the Eastern Church on that day. When Rome picked up Advent, it was really in the 6th century, so a couple centuries later, and they didn't baptize at Christmas time. They didn't do that. But the whole meaning of the word Advent is the coming or the presence or the arrival. And so in one sense, you could say Christmas was the arrival, right? So this is sort of a preparation for the arrival. So that's how that name got spread across the beginnings of Advent. That's why we have these colors of purple vestments during Advent, almost like Lent. You know, the John the Baptist in the New Testament says, prepare the way of the Lord, you know, repent and believe. There's kind of the repentance here to prepare for the coming of the Lord, make things straight in your life. Do a little bit more praying and a little bit more of looking forward, not only to Christmas as a memorial of his birth on earth, but also of his coming again at the end of time. And so there is that preparing yourselves for the last judgment in a little bit. See, so we have all these dimensions there in there. At one point, one of these church writers said that there are really three comings of Christ. There is coming in history. There's also coming in majesty at the end of the world. But also in our time, there's a coming of Christ in mystery. That is to say, mysterion is the Greek word for sacrament. So we prepare ourselves to celebrate the feast of Christmas.
Now, you mentioned the purple vestments as being one of the ways in which we visually symbolize Advent. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other symbols we associate with this season?
Well, one of them has become very popular in recent years. It's been popular, I should say, for centuries in Christianity. And it came from Lutheran piety, actually, from the Lutheran Church in Germany. And it just found its way into Catholic practice as well. And so that's really when you go to almost all Catholic churches, you'll see Advent wreath up there with four candles marking the four Sundays or weeks of Advent. And it's kind of a reminder of the Christmas coming, right?
As Christmas has become a bit less entwined with its religious purpose, some of these traditions have become a bit more secular, mm-hmm. Like Advent and the kinds of Advent calendars that we might be familiar with. How do we see Advent living on in secular celebrations of Christmas?
You know, I can't think of any way that we do it. And let me put this in kind of a positive light, because I remember when I did my liturgical studies at Notre Dame, you know, for my doctorate in liturgical studies, the Jesuit there, who was quite a fellow, he even admitted that one time he was kind of disgusted that people were putting up Christmas decorations before Christmas and all that. And one older priest said to him, no, you have to let the people have their Christmas. You know, that kind of changed his heart. So I think that's what we find now, isn't it? Christmas decorations are almost going up after Halloween, not in all places, but in some places. And so there is this kind of anticipation looking toward Christmas and opening ourselves up into peace on earth and goodwill toward one another that comes with Christmas songs we hear on the radio. So I think there's a kind of something Advent-like, even in the Second World, for Christmas. You know, these movies, you know, It's a Wonderful Life, and all of those really kind of celebrate the goodness of being human. And that's what we celebrate at Christmas, isn't it? God's become human, right? And now he totally identifies with us in our humanity. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Father Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you, and thanks for inviting me here. I really enjoyed it.
Father John Lawrence is a Jesuit priest and a former professor of theology at Marquette University. Atomic Records, Klingers East, and the Milwaukee County Stadium. Wisconsin artist Nate Rose recently gained attention for recreating all of these local landmarks of the past as tiny paintings inside Altoid tins. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez speaks with Rose about his latest series of paintings called Milwaukee Memories and what inspires him.
You've recently gained popularity for your tiny paintings that you've created inside Altoid containers. What inspired you to start this series of paintings?
Well, I can't take credit for coming up with this idea. I think I saw it on Instagram or something a while back. But I just had an Altoid container laying around, and at that point I had been oil painting for about a year. So I decided to just try it out and put some paint in the bottom of the tin, use that as the palette. And at that time I lived on the east side of Milwaukee, and so I just walked down to the art museum, sat on the grass, made a little painting of it, and that's kind of how I started the the tiny Altoid painting. So it's only been about a year and a half that I've been doing these. And so the lid of the Altoid tin has a little 2x2 canvas on it. And then in the bottom part of the tin, there's little dabs of oil paint, the various colors that I use. And then kind of in the middle of the bottom part of the tin is where I mix them. The little painting itself will probably be dry in about a week, but these little dabs of oil paint could be wet underneath for months and months.
And when did you start the series of painting Milwaukee memories or Wisconsin memories?
Like 6 weeks ago. Yeah, this is like a pretty recent thing. It was actually a shower thought, I think early October, maybe late September. I was actually thinking about what local landmark I wanted to paint next. And I was like, oh, it'd be nice if I could paint like Port Plaza Mall in Green Bay, which is no longer there, but I grew up in Green Bay. It was kind of like where we always hung out. And then I thought to myself, well, why not just paint it? And so I did a bunch of research and found photos and tried my best to remember kind of like what it looked like, what the vibe was. And then I just painted it, took a picture of what's there now, which is really boring.
And you mentioned Port Plaza Mall, but for listeners who aren't familiar with your work, tell me about some of the places you have painted.
Well, here in Milwaukee, I painted Atomic Records, which was on Locust, closed around 2009, I believe. I painted Klinger's East, which closed a few years ago, also on Locust, but in River West. I painted Fuel Cafe, which was on Center Street in River West, and Milwaukee County Stadium. So those are the Milwaukee landmarks that I've painted so far.
And tell me a little bit about the memories that you associate with those places.
I have a lot of memories with all these places. So far, all of the memory paintings that I've done are places that I have personal connection to. So Atomic Records, I used to live above it on the Oakland side. Me and my buddy were DJs at the time. This was 2008 to 2009. So we had like four turntables set up in the living room. We'd go down to Atomic and buy records all the time. And then we were actually lived there when it closed. So when I started this series and I thought about what to do in Milwaukee, Atomic was like the first thing that came to mind. And then Klinger's East is just like very cozy kind of Wisconsin tavern. I have many fond memories of watching Packers games there and, you know, just eating burgers and cheese curds and all that. And then County Stadium, I just went there all the time as a kid with my dad. We'd go to Brewers games all the time. And then Fuel Cafe, I didn't go there a ton when I lived here in 2008, 2009-ish. But I would definitely go there sometimes and just like sketch and hang out.
Can you walk me through the process you go through to create a tiny painting? From even the beginning step of how you decide what you're going to paint.
So first off, I look for things that are either visually interesting, like the Milwaukee Art Museum, or that have a personal connection to me, or that are just sort of weird roadside attraction-y, strange things, or that have like a big nostalgia factor. I made a tiny painting of the world's largest potato masher. In September, I went down to Iowa, made a tiny painting of the world's largest strawberry. I live right down the road from the world's largest hex nut. So yeah, always looking for these like weird, kind of kitschy roadside attraction type things. The second thing then is doing a lot of planning, actually. Sometimes I'll just go out into nature or wherever with my paints and like a blank canvas and just do something on the spot. More often than not, though, like I'll visit the place once, take a bunch of reference photos, kind of note the weather, note like where the sun is, note like if it can be a windy day or if I need it to be still. Is there going to be water? Do I need like the reflection of something? There's a lot of planning and thought that goes into that. And then once I'm ready to go, like I have a plan in mind, then I'll get my paint all together and everything and then like head out and then go make it. Some of these, though, I've done like at home. Obviously, I can't go and like see Atomic Records or County Stadium. So those I do at home after doing like a bunch of research. And so for the ones that no longer exist, like I'll try my best to find stuff online, photos to reference and things like that. Hopefully there was something like in an old newspaper. But also if it's something that's been around since 2007, I'll use the Google Maps Street View. So all of these things. And then basically when I'm ready to go, it's for these tiny paintings, it's just putting the oil paint in the bottom of the tin. And that's basically my palette. And I have a bunch of tiny brushes, and then I go for it.
How long does each painting take you?
The tiny paintings, probably like 2 hours for a really intricate one. Like the Atomic Records one has a lot of detail, you know, a lot of lettering and things like that. Same with the Fuel Cafe one, Klinger's one. Actually, all the Milwaukee ones took about 2 hours now that I think about it.
And what would you say your favorite part of the process is when you're painting?
Well, I just like that you can do whatever you want. Like, it's pretty nice. Like, you can always change anything. The Fuel Cafe painting, I put a squirrel smoking a cigarette in there because I can. Things like that, you know, just paint a little happy cloud in there like Bob Ross, doesn't matter. So I like the control, like when you paint, because you can just do anything. A lot of the cityscapes and things that I do, like I just leave out like the light poles, telephone poles, and like the wires and stuff like that, because I'm just trying to make a beautiful painting. So I think I just like that about painting, is that you have creative license to just change whatever you want.
I love that. And you also do big paintings, including abstract paintings. What inspires your abstract art?
When I'm trying to paint representationally, it's a lot of effort. It takes a lot of work to do that. So after I've done that for a while, for a couple of months, I feel kind of burnt out. And sometimes I just want to like go be free. And so then I just sort of get into like a phase of abstract paintings. And for that, I usually use acrylic because it dries a lot faster and you can add a bunch of stuff to it to make it thicker, more textured, things like that. So I don't know. I feel like it's almost kind of like a release after doing these very planned out, painstakingly detailed representational type paintings.
So what's different about painting abstractly versus painting landscapes?
Well, the obvious difference is that painting landscapes is painting something representational, painting something that's there and easily recognizable, or abstract is, you know, it's just that, it's abstract. But I still feel like there's still some kind of a connection. Like a lot of the colors that I use for my abstract paintings are actually inspired by the National Park Service posters of the early 20th century. So something about the colors that they used spoke to me. So a lot of the abstract paintings I do still use that sort of theme. So I guess they're still kind of tied into nature a little bit. Also, a lot of my abstract paintings have kind of like a radial theme. So I feel like in one way or another, I know this is an abstract answer to a question about abstract paintings, but in one way or another, like I feel like there's still some sort of natural sort of feel to them.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that answer. Before we wrap up, I do want to ask you, what do you hope people come away with after seeing your artwork, tiny and normal-sized paintings?
Well, I just hope that they have fond memories of some of these places like I do, and it just sort of hits them in the nostalgic feels a little bit, and also just, you know, stop and appreciate what's there, because in my research for all these paintings, like I found that it is very hard to find these photos of these places that are no longer there. So I don't know, I would say take a lot of pictures with your phone, because if a place goes out of business or is no longer there for whatever reason, like it's nice to be able to look back and see them.
Absolutely. Well, Nate, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing your artwork with me.
Thanks for having me.
Nate Rose is a Wisconsin artist who recently gained popularity for his series of tiny paintings inside Altoid tins. He spoke with Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn why hazelnuts could be the solution to Wisconsin's loss of dairy farms. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A new crop is taking root in the upper Midwest, hazelnuts. Many curious farmers are drawn to the novelty of a native nut. Farmland in the upper Midwest is mostly used for corn and soybeans, and most hazelnuts are grown overseas. Perennial crops like hazelnuts bring many climate benefits. They suck up agricultural pollution and lock up planet-warming carbon. And they hold onto soil that otherwise quickly erodes from farmland. WUWM's Lena Tran went to a farm in Plymouth, Wisconsin, where farmers gathered to learn about the crop. We'll hear from some of those farmers first. Then, Lena speaks with Jason Fishbach from the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative. It's a research hub that formed to support this emerging industry.
I'm Deborah. I do love the plant. I like growing them. I haven't had great success because of the critters, but it still gets me out and I'm learning a lot and enjoying it. I think it was just because it's a perennial crop and I was excited to think about how that could be a very healthful thing for the soils and for wildlife.
Tom Grip. I just started growing them about 20 years ago. Initially, well, for the first 10 years, it was just a complete hobby. And now that I've retired, it's my retirement hobby is planting hazelnuts and various other sorts of fruit and berry. Where I live in the Driftless area, we have terrible problems with soil erosion. And every time I turn the soil over, a lot of it washes away. So just I have the good fortune to own some land. And so I just thought I'd look into planting different things.
My name is Jan.
Are you already like...
My husband and I have 5 acres up near Shiocton, and he's got about 300 trees in right now. Pat, with the green bandana.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't know what she told you, but we ran a professional landscape service for lawn maintenance and landscape service for over 20 years. So we were in the green industry. We moved from landscaping to farming, hobby farm, obviously, small, 5 acres. And we started with apples, and by visiting the apple seminars in the universities, you go to Hazelnuts real quick, and you find Jason, and he runs an excellent program. And at this point, I wish I didn't have the apple trees, and I just had all hazelnuts.
Really? What is it about hazelnuts?
I think they're just going to be so easy to grow, and the uniqueness.
The uniqueness because it's from here.
Well, uniqueness says then you can't really find anybody that has a hazelnut field like you can an apple field. Being from Appleton, there's probably 20 orchards within 10 minutes of the city. I think we're the only hazelnut orchard within 10 minutes from the city. The biggest challenge, of course, there's always the money, but to do it right. And again, Jason and everybody at the university have been wonderful telling us the correct way to do it, so you don't have to rip it out and do it again and rip it out and do it again. So hopefully we're doing it right the first time.
Jason Fishbach with the University of Wisconsin Madison Division of Extension, and I'm the Emerging Crops Outreach Specialist.
What is your hazelnut origin story?
I don't even remember anymore.
Because it's been so long?
Yeah, pretty much. So I got interested in hazelnuts when I was in grad school back in 2003. But then when I moved up to Ashland and took a job with UW Extension as the agriculture agent for the two counties, one of my charges was to help diversify the ag economy up here. Our rural counties, far away from markets, like elsewhere in the country, well, in Wisconsin, has seen a decline in the number of small and medium-sized dairy herds. So, for example, in Bayfield County, we went from 120 to about 5 dairy farms. You know, it's just complete collapse of the dairy economy. So we needed to find other options for farmers and for the ag economy, and started looking around, and turns out that there's this plant that grows wild all over Bayfield County called American hazelnut. So the analog to cranberries is really pretty good, because cranberries, that industry started from a plant that was growing in the wild. And so at the time, I naively thought, oh, no problem, we'll just turn American hazelnut into a crop, just like we did with cranberries. But easier said than done. So we're still working at it. Ultimately, the goal is to develop the hazelnut industry in the upper Midwest, centered around the American hazelnut germplasm. And it turns out it has all kinds of other climate benefits if we can do this at scale.
Yeah. So germplasm, meaning you're using some of the genetic material from what's growing in the wild and trying to breed that with other things to work better for commercial purposes?
Exactly, yeah. So there's two approaches to our breeding program. The first is just simple search and screen. You know, no one's ever looked at these wild American hazelnut populations for really nice plants that could support commercial production, large nuts, good production year to year, good pest resistance. So we've started doing that in 2007, I think, is when we first started, you know, just tromping around the woods looking for cool plants, make copies of it. That's trying to develop cultivars of pure American hazelnut. Then the other approach, which was farther along when we started, because a lot of our early adopters and private breeders started, I mean, it goes back 100 years, but they crossed the European hazelnut, which supplies 99.99% of the global hazelnut market. They crossed European hazelnut with American hazelnut. to try to get the best of both worlds, because European hazelnut can't survive the winters or disease pressure up here, but American hazelnut just doesn't produce large enough nuts for hazelnut markets. So the goal is to combine the traits of two and come up with a good cultivars that growers can grow. We've done it. We've got our top 5 to 10 cultivars that we have identified from that breeding work. And I'm actually standing in a greenhouse today where we're working on propagation to try to make more copies of these for growers, because it turns out it's really hard to propagate, which has slowed down our industry a lot.
Huh. Well, you mentioned some of those benefits that you discovered along the way. Can you dig into why hazelnuts are so compelling as we consider, you know, what it looks like for Wisconsin agriculture to adapt to climate change?
Sure. Okay, so the first is the actual change in carbon dynamics from agricultural landscapes, right? And this is big. For this to work, it has to be at a big scale. And there's a lot of factors at play whether or not this will actually happen. But we know that a transition from a meat-based to a plant-based diet is one really effective tool to reduce carbon emissions from agricultural lands. And hazelnuts are a super protein source. So if more people ate nuts and ate less meat, then we could reduce carbon emissions. Okay, but there's a lot of variables in that, right? But that's one benefit to hazelnuts, because we don't really have a nut crop for the upper Midwest, particularly Wisconsin and Minnesota. And so this would be our region's first nut crop. The second thing then would be, if it's deployed at scale, we reduce tillage, and we can actually build soil organic matter and fix more carbon, both in the plants themselves, but also reductions in soil disturbance, because this is a long-lived perennial crop, you know, that live for 100 years easily. Okay, so you got carbon sequestration benefits potentially. Then on the other side is carbon mitigation, right? So we're dealing with larger storm events, more erosive storm events. And anytime we can keep roots in the ground with perennial plants, that's just going to help protect those soils from storm events and the runoff events that we keep getting more and more of.
Mm-hmm.
And that you don't necessarily need as big a scale if you do it strategically. If you put these woody perennials in areas that are particularly conducive to erosion, or put it in ways that you can at least stop the soil from upstream from moving further downstream. So strip plantings, riparian buffers, planting on slopes, all that kind of stuff. So that's why we're excited about hazelnuts as a crop. Of course, this goes nowhere unless people start eating hazelnuts. So part of this also is market development.
Right. I mean, what does that look like for you?
At the end of the day, this is up to farmers and consumers to figure out. But at the university, we're just trying to set the stage for success, applying lessons that we've learned from other crops. So one thing we know is for a capital intensive crop like hazelnuts, it's really helpful if you're clustered with other growers, because then it makes it way easier to share things like harvesting equipment, processing equipment. It makes it easier to pool volume so you can access bigger markets. When we get small plantings scattered all over the place, it can make it really hard to develop efficient supply chains. So by working with our grower community up front here and trying to encourage them or help them form grower clusters, that's a big part of what we're trying to do. And that sets the stage then for, hopefully, they can access bigger markets at price points that consumers can pay, and they also can make money. The game then from a profitability standpoint is, if farmers are just selling a commodity and all of the upstream value added is owned by other people, not the growers, then the growers just aren't going to be successful. So we're trying to help the growers own that value chain so they can capture as much of that retail food dollar as they can, because it's going to make their system better. So that's where something like the American Hazelnut Company, we formed that in 2014. So it gives an opportunity for their member growers to own that value chain and actually produce a value-added product that they can take to market. Because one thing we've seen is, as other industries, other hazelnut production regions grow, oftentimes they're left to just selling to the biggest buyers, and that would be Ferrero. Maker of
the delicious chocolates.
Yep. And roughly 40% of the world's hazelnut supply goes to Nutella. And so, you know, Nutella is a huge product. they have to have low prices. They really squeeze their suppliers. And so you get paid global commodity prices.
Right.
We would rather our growers produce Nutella, you know, or some version of it, some high grossing, high margin, value added hazelnut product that they own from production of the nuts all the way to the sale to, you know, retail sale to the consumer. Long story short, we're just trying to apply other successes from other industries to our fledgling hazelnut industry, try to set them up for success.
This is WUWM's Lena Tran, and you're listening to Lake Effect. My guest is Jason Fishbach. He's with the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative. So this hub of researchers and emerging crop specialists started back in 2007. I'm curious, what is the challenge that kind of defines this phase of the work?
We launched in 2007, and by far the number one priority was genetics, plant breeding, trying to develop improved cultivars. And now that we've at least progressed there, the number one bottleneck by far is propagation. If we can't get copies of these good plants out to growers, we've got nothing. So mm-hmm. that's why, you know, that's where I spend most of my time these days is trying to figure this out, try to find methods and nursery partners and everybody else to stand up a team that can get these plants produced. And we're making progress, but it's still way too slow. To give you some perspective where we're at, our goal is 20,000 acres by 2030. That's going to require 9 million plants. Right now, we're producing maybe a 1,500 to 2,000 a year. So we've got a long way to go.
And this is just kind of like a quirk of the plant itself.
It's hard to get. So there's different methods that you use, but a pretty common one is via stem cuttings. So you take a piece off the mother plant and you stick it in soil with some rooting hormone, and ideally it grows roots and then continues growing. This is how it's done with many different industries. Hazelnuts don't do that. We're making progress figuring out a protocol for how to do it, but it's not working very well.
Mm-hmm.
The other way that woody crop industries are propagated, tissue culture, where you're generating a new cell from a single bud and you're doing it in the lab and then growing out those microplants. And hazelnuts also don't do well in tissue culture. It appears it has something to do with American hazelnut, which is, we think, because it's adapted to really dry, sandy soils, its stress response is to just stop growing and go dormant.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing we want the plant to do when it's being propagated, it needs to be actively growing. So anytime we take a cutting or do something as part of the propagation process, we're disturbing that plant. It's in stress mode, and so it stops growing. So that's what we're fighting against, is that in American hazelnut. But of course, it's not all American hazelnut plants, right? There's some genotypes that are relatively easy to propagate. Just turns out it's not the ones that we want to propagate.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Like, what is your relationship with hazelnuts now? You know, years, almost 20 years later, it's your white whale. It's really stubborn. How do you think about this thing in your life?
That's a good question. It definitely, there are days of frustration, you know, but then you get out there in the field in the fall, and you see the potential of these top plants. You see these plants just loaded with hazelnuts. And then, you know, you get them cracked down, roasted, and you're eating them. It's like, whoa, this is so worth pursuing. Again, harvest time is my favorite, because you go in there and you start digging around in the plants looking for the nuts, right, to harvest them. And in there is just like this whole world of insect activity. Katydids, walking sticks all over the place, tree frogs, moth larva. I mean, it's just this whole world that you've brought into the agricultural field that wasn't there before. You know, it'd be so great if the American consumer could experience fresh roasted hazelnuts, not the stuff that gets imported from Turkey, and we could grow it in the Midwest and actually have a nut crop that farmers could benefit from. You know, you go out to Oregon and or California, and nuts are huge and they're really lucrative, profitable crops. Our growers in the Midwest don't have crop like it, So that's what keeps me going, is the potential.
You're tackling these challenges, you know, trying to solve problems for the people that might follow you, but you're working on long timescales here.
Yeah, and I've been at it long enough now, we're definitely seeing generational change. So there was a group of early adopter growers that I started working with, and now they've aged out. They've either died or just retired out, and so now I'm working with a whole new cohort. You know, we want younger active farmers that are ready to take on a 15 to 20 year project, because we feel like we're far enough along and that we can start scaling production. So we're seeing that it's shifting from kind of the retiree folks to a younger, more production oriented group. But that's plant breeding. That's woody crop development, is you're standing on shoulders of generations before, and you carry the torch for a while, and eventually you get it. Mm-hmm. I just can sustain the effort long enough.
Jason Fishbach is a co-leader of the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative. He and a group of hazelnut curious farmers spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from the director of Milwaukee Recreation, who is retiring in the new year. Plus, we'll tell you where to find some of the best desserts in Milwaukee. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.